Welcome to the Top M&A Entrepreneurs. This episode is brought to you by The Magnolia Firm, the specialty M&A brokerage firm helping you sell your business. This deal of the week is a trucking company and freight forwarding. Just started 3 years ago. Let's take a look at the trailing 12 months income statement. All right, you can see the gross profit is doing $980,000. And you can see the net income for the business is $206,000. He has some add backs to the business. For his SDE is $298,000. If you're interested in the business, get the SIM, get all the data, and make a fully formed offer. Just be aware there will be competitors to this business. Now let's get on with the show.
Welcome to the Top M&A Entrepreneurs. Today, my guest is Josh Marsden out of Phoenix. Josh has acquired 14 e-commerce companies in a period of a year and a half. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm honored.
So you're just down the road from me in Phoenix, and you and I met about 2 years ago in a mastermind group.
Yeah, that's right? Correct.
Yeah. Yep. Cool. Yep. So, Josh, you've acquired 14 companies, but let's talk about what you were doing at the time you said, I want to start acquiring a company. What were you doing?
Wow. That's a good question. So, you know, this was 2021 and, you know, 2021 was my first down year in business when it came to, you know, just sales. You know, I was running a marketing agency from early 2013 up until the end of 2021. And unfortunately, 2021 started off, you could say, on the wrong foot. I had signed 50% of my company over to someone. And a few months into the year, he wasn't meeting his obligations. And we unfortunately had to dissolve the partnership. But unfortunately, it left me with a business that we had reduced purposely to fit into our mutual plans. And so I had to grind it out from that point on throughout the rest of 2021 to get the business up to a substantial revenue and profit position for myself and all the staff that I had to live off of the business. But, you know, long story short, I had a plan and a goal in mind anyway to become an e-com aggregator. And that's what him and I were doing. And then, of course, you know, like I said, we had to dissolve the partnership. And so from that point until the end of the year, I was still like, I want to, you know, become an e-com aggregator. I need to make this transition, you know, into buying e-com companies, managing them. This way I don't have to sell agency services anymore, which, you know, I had appreciated for the past, you know, 8.5 or so years, but, you know, it really wasn't serving me as much as I'd like, you know, because I had bigger goals and I wanted to, you know, generate a 9+ figure exit at some point in the future. And so at the end of 2021, you know, I finally, you know, decided that, you know, I was going to make that hard, swift transition from selling agency services and, you know, and relying on that to buying e-commerce companies and managing those to scale those up. This way we can then package them and then sell them in a portfolio roll up in the future.
Let me ask you about your agency services. Now, what were you doing in this agency? Were you actually helping e-commerce owners build their e-commerce company?
Yeah. We had a lot of successes, you know, and we helped literally thousands of e-com businesses. And I say thousands because we had summits that we hosted where we hosted thousands of people, you know, thousands of e-com business owners. We sold services, you know, and so we helped a lot of e-com companies from early 2013 up until the end of 2021 when we decided not to, you know, sell client services anymore. And over the last several years, you know, we really identified a formula, a process to be able to really get the most return on ad spend from paid advertising for our clients, for our e-com companies that we were servicing. And we framed it the ARM5 formula, and there's a meaning.
ARM5,
cool. Yeah, and there's a meaning behind, you know, ARM5. You know, that I could explain if you'd like, but it all came back to what we saw consistently from a strategy and a process perspective working in our clients up to that point to get the most return on ad spend, which helped them grow faster than working with other agencies out there.
Yeah, I'm going to ask you about this ARM5, but what type of customer made the best in your agency? And this is all building this context. Like, is it e-commerce and it's a physical product, or is it a, you know, coaching product, or what did it look like?
Yeah. So from 2017 on, we only wanted to work with physical product e-com companies, and our marketing really focused on speaking to that niche. You know, we rarely took on companies outside of that niche from that point on. So most of our experience from that point on was 100% physical product e-com.
Was it FBA or Shopify or high price point, low price point?
Yeah, it's okay. So I laugh when someone says that, because to me, Amazon's just a sales channel. There's no such thing as an Amazon business necessarily. It's just a business that relies on the sales from Amazon, but they're leaving direct to consumer, that channel, dormant, and they, you know, should focus on it. So we were really helping companies apply direct response digital marketing strategies and processes to the direct to consumer channel. So that would mean that we would work with, like, you know, companies that were built on Shopify or on BigCommerce or WooCommerce, you know, one of those e-commerce platforms, typically Shopify.
Yeah. And what would you do? You redesign the site, build a nice funnel, get a lead magnet, find the right channel to advertise, use PPC and SEO, all of the above?
Yeah, just about all of the above. I mean, you know, paid advertising was our biggest, you know, selling point, you know, because when you do paid advertising at a very high level and you're scaling and you're spending, you know, 100,000 plus a month in ad spend, and you know what you're doing, you know, you can grow a business very, very fast. And so, you know, a lot of people came to us because of that. I mean, it helped too that I published a few books on Facebook advertising for e-commerce, and one of them was an international bestseller. So, you know, that was really what drew people to us. And that was the biggest strength we offered to all of our clients was paid advertising. But the thing is that you can't just do paid advertising alone. You know, you have to really have a strong brand to get the best possible results from paid advertising. And so we always published content consistently, which is an SEO play as well. For all of our clients, that's part of the Arm 5 formula, is publishing content on a consistent basis. We would also, you know, use funnels as well, not just drive people to a Shopify site. You know, funnels typically
about,
traditionally.
YouTube and maybe celebrity sponsors in there too?
Well, we would use YouTube, like YouTube ads, but yeah. But we wouldn't, you know, do a whole lot of, like, you know, celebrity partnerships and stuff like that.
All right. So I could tell you about being a horror story relying on one channel of ad spend, Google AdWords, yeah, in my past. So, so this partnership with this guy didn't work out, and you go, okay, forget it. I don't need anybody. I'm going to do it my own.
Yep.
Yeah. And you did what? What was the first steps? Like, I am going to go buy an e-commerce company, a distressed one, a great overvalued one, or, you know, a profitable one, or what was the thesis on this and the buying strategy?
Yeah, it's such a good question. I mean, you know, it's funny because, you know, we've grown and I've grown so much since the first purchase we made. You know, at the time when we made our, you know, first purchase, I mean, you know, you think, you know what, you know, but you really don't, you know,
every you know, day.
Right. I mean, well, meaning that, you know, even, you know, back then we were buying, like, we bought a group of businesses in early spring 2022. And out of that group, only one of them was a really good business that we should have bought. The other businesses we shouldn't have bought. But, you know, we bought those other businesses because we thought that we could buy those businesses. They were good purchases that we could, you know, turn them around, and because they were beat up Chevys, as I call them, that we would have to put some work into to get good valuations out of those businesses. But the problem was that it just, you know, once a business is dead, it's super hard to revive that business. And some of the businesses we bought had been, like, not profitable throughout 2021, or had a previously working marketing strategy that was not working anymore, and because of changes with Facebook ads, for example, and we hadn't had marketing and sales running for several months prior to us purchasing it. So we were buying like businesses that, you know, we were really, you know, wasting
our time. Distressed businesses. Were they distressed? Yeah, when I say distressed, do you mean unprofitable or profitable?
Unprofitable.
Yeah. Unprofitable. So you could not put the cardiac arrest machines on there and get them back going, even though with a guy with a worldwide book on Facebook.
I'm not saying
that's, you know.
It's okay. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I'm just saying it's a difficult task to revive a dead business.
Yeah. Oh yeah, 100%. I mean, because you know sometimes businesses have inherent issues. You know, like one of those businesses, their COGS were, you know, pricing was way too high, and there was just no way that we could buy customers, you know, profitably with the COGS the way they were, and we didn't see that until we really got our.
Even if you increased the price. But you couldn't double the price because there was no elasticity in the market.
Correct. Yeah, yeah. I love how you said that. You just spoke economics there. that's true. 100% true. 100% true. That was the case with that one.
Yeah. I mean, that's always like everybody looks at the business, COGS are big, and they go, well, let's increase the price. I go, well, five of your competitors are below your price. So they're just your customers are just going to swim over that pond.
Right.
Yeah. They're not going to work. So.
Yep.
You came out with this strategy. You got a lot of lessons with it. How many of those businesses did you shelf that you originally purchased? Did you say we can't get it going?
No, that's okay. So we've shelved four businesses so far. I mean, you know, and the one good business out of that initial group of purchases, unfortunately, the partnership didn't work out, which can happen. And and that got dissolved. You know, maybe I think it was like 2 months into it. But you know, it's night and day, like where we are now versus then. I mean, when it comes to like our purchasing process, I mean, it's so rigorous now and, you know, there's so much detail to it. And we also are just much more strict, on like what businesses that we would even consider purchasing. And also our buy box has changed. Like back then we were just like wanting to buy businesses. We didn't care. I mean, like one of the, you know, one of those businesses we bought for zero down. We were like, yes, we bought a business for zero down, but it was a shit, it was a crap business, you know? I mean, but now it's like we're buying businesses valued between 1 and 5 million. We're buying, you know, multi seven figure businesses. You know, businesses are going to help us get to our big, hairy, audacious goal faster and also with less headaches along the way versus those early businesses. You know, with businesses that, you know, are going to help us accomplish that 100 million annual goal that we have, because, you know, we're looking to build a portfolio of businesses that are doing 100 million annually. This way we could package them up and then go sell them.
Yeah. So you're looking for a 100 million portfolio, the total price at some point. Yeah. It's a 10-year goal or 5-year goal.
That's the gross revenue the entire portfolio that we want to hit.
So looking at a baseball metaphor, you definitely took some swings at some pitches outside your strike zone and you fouled or bunted out, you know, ground out or something. So you learned a lot of lessons. Now, what is a good business? You stay disciplined. What does the characteristics of a good e-commerce business look like? Okay, the revenue has to be top line what?
Has to be at minimum like 7 figures in the last 12 months.
And the bottom line has to be what kind of margin on that?
Yeah,
above at least double digits to what?
Yeah, I mean, at least a 15% in net profit margin.
Okay.
On that.
And the cost of goods would be what, 50%, somewhere right around there less?
It's hard to say just because, you know, in some markets, you know, you pay less per click. And so therefore you can afford a higher COGS, you know. In other markets, you know, it's a little tighter, there's more competition. And so, you know, you need a lower COGS to actually, you know, be competitive. So it really depends, but.
And so it depends on what you have to pay per click and cost of acquisition of a customer, right?
Correct. Yep.
Yeah. Through that funnel.
Yep. Correct.
Yep. When you look at the expenses, what do you look for when you're looking down the chart of accounts and you see expenses? Hey, these are in line or these are out of line. It's a red flag. I'm passing. Or you discount it.
Yeah. I mean, it would be a red flag. I mean, it wouldn't be a red flag. It would be a yellow flag if, for example, because we have P&Ls, you know, we're reviewing in the acquisition process with the new, you know, potential acquisitions. And And then we get to a stage in our due diligence process where we have to go through, you know, their business account and really verify all the transactions. And if something shows up that wasn't showing up on the actual P&L, you know, that's a yellow flag. And then we're going to reach out to the owner seller and be like, hey, what is this? Can you explain what this is? Why wasn't this on the P&L? You know, and, you know, and that wouldn't be something that's, you know, we would completely, you know, decide right away that we don't want to buy the business. It just really depends on what the owner seller says, and we'll go from there, and also what it is and what the amount is, you know, because if it's a, you know, if it's a high, you know, if it's a debt, a high liability, obviously, you know, that's going to be a reason for us to walk away from the deal. But you know, we're working with, you know, some, you know, successful businesses here and business owners that, you know, are, you know, a little bit more seasoned and, you know, usually aren't trying to hide stuff from us, you know, because, you know, they don't want to waste their time and we don't want to waste our time either. And, you know, we haven't found that too much as we've increased our buy box, you know, into businesses that are, you know, ran by, you know, seasoned, experienced entrepreneurs.
So what you're translating, now that you're not swinging at these pitches, these outside your strike zone, there are these bigger businesses are more honest and transparent
usually.
About their business.
Not always, but usually.
Yeah, let me go back to that balance sheet. What do you do if you do see the debt on there? You know, if it's a debt to equity ratio, it's really high. Is that a red flag or yellow flag you pass on immediately? What was the debt used for?
Yeah, right? I mean, because we don't want to buy any negative net profit businesses, you know. And you know, so if something like that shows up, you know, we won't even consider it. I mean, it won't even get past step one. Like in our first step in our due diligence checklist, there, you know, we looked to find out whether or not there is that much debt in the business. And if there is that much debt in the business, you know, it's not a good business, because we want to buy a company that's profitable on day zero, you know, meaning that we're stepping into a profitable business with good cash flow. And so we don't want a business that doesn't have that.
Yeah. When you buy a cash flow business, what do you look for in paying in a multiple on these seven figure businesses for an e-commerce? Yeah. What is like standard? Like, hey, this is, do you use all the formulas, discount cash flow, or do you use comps, or all of the above?
Yeah. So, one of my mentors is, the CEO of DealFlow, a brokerage, and also it's co-owned by several other mentors, Josh Snow and Los Hustle. And they've told me fairly recently that a business that is doing up to $5 million annually can get up to a 4x multiple in e-commerce.
$5 million annually, is that top line or you bottom?
Top line, gross revenue. Okay, top line. Yep. Yeah, and then if it's doing over $5 million annually, then it could get up to a 6x. So that's how we view, you know, multiples when we're applying multiples to potential acquisitions.
Yeah. And how much multiple do you bake in if the business is like, hey, we got a lot of reoccurring customers, or there's a really big profit margin? It's going to help that? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. No, that's a very desirable, you know, those are two very desirable traits, having, you know, reoccurring revenue and also having, you know, high profit margin. I mean, we would definitely, you know, give it more of a, you know, increase on the multiple, if, you know, we're looking at a business that has those characteristics. So if it's doing less than 5 million annually, you know, there's a chance that it'll get around 3.5, maybe. I mean, a 4 is rare, you know, when it's up to a 5 million, you know, annual revenue. It really has to have like a lot of characteristics, like trademarks, IPs, patents, you know, unique product that can't be ripped off, you know, that nobody else sells. Due to, you know, maybe a worldwide patent, for example, and it has those characteristics you mentioned, then maybe we may make the argument that there's a 4x there. But, you know, usually it's about a 3 to 3.5.
And do you have a committee that you go around and talk to in this group, or as you go now that you're by yourself, or?
You know, I've got a great team behind me. You know, my head of acquisitions, you know, he's a stellar guy, very experienced in the M&A space. And, you know, he runs our acquisitions now. You know, at one point I was the man doing a lot and including head of acquisition. But luckily, you know, he's on the team and he's doing a great job there. So, you know, I actually defer to him in a lot of cases. But then if there's, you know, if we need outside wisdom, you know, we'll reach out to like the mastermind that we're in, you know,
the
we'll
deal get flow guys,
from, you know, different yeah. people, you know, and luckily, you know, I've been in the space now for over 10 years, you know, so I have a solid Rolodex. I've got people I could text that are,
what are your thoughts? Yeah.
You know, yeah, very experienced M&A people that can give me feedback. So, you know, if we need that feedback, we'll get it, but usually we can handle it internally.
Yeah. What kind of decision-making do you put on if a business has, you know, 90, 100% of customer acquisition comes from PPC versus a business where, you know, 50% comes from PPC and 50% comes from a great social media following, like let's say 100,000 Instagram followers, 100,000 Facebook followers. And he's done a great job of building a community there.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah. So basically you're talking about a company that actually has a brand versus a company that doesn't have a brand, but uses paid advertising and has had success.
Yeah.
Yeah. We would definitely give more weight to the company that has a brand and also is using paid advertising. And we've seen, you know, through the application of the RM5 formula that when a company has a brand and then you do paid advertising, the potential for the ROI from paid advertising is massive.
It's a higher click-through ratio.
Oh, yeah. Well, not the click-through ratio, but just the return on ad spend. So, you know, like, you know, for example, I'll just use this as an example. We worked with a successful supplement business back in 2020 and 2019. And in 2020, we saw days where we were spending like $1,200 and we were making back $135,000. Ridiculous.
What? For what kind of product was that?
Yeah, they had a whole suite of supplements. And,
wow. Yeah.
Yeah. And the reason why, and it was like cortisol, you know, formula control, for example, you know, there was, what's it called? What's the supplement that helps you with your stomach? Probiotics. That's right.
Yeah. Probiotics.
Yeah. Like I take their probiotics still, you know, for example. And, that company saw 600% ROI from every dollar spent on ads throughout 2020 with us. And that's because they had a strong brand coming in and we maintained the brand and kept pushing more valuable content to build the brand up even further. And so a brand that actually has that, you know, there's so much potential for paid advertising and, you know, the return on ad spend, we can see that.
So do you like supplement companies, the vitamins line? And the reason I guess, like, I clicked on something at Jocko Wikilinks and he's got a huge brand with his podcast and his background, and now he's selling vitamins and his little protein cookies, and he's going to follow you everywhere if you click on his product.
Oh, no.
He's got to be making a ton of cash on that.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, that's – I've seen a lot of examples like that where, you know, you've had someone build a very strong brand, like, for themselves, and then they've added e-commerce, and then that e-commerce company just – blows up because, you know, he has a brand, he has trust.
Yeah.
That really makes a big impact.
Yeah. So is it, how would you score it if it's a celebrity versus just a great product? And I'm, if I think about looking at a brand, I can't think of one that would not led by a celebrity. Like if they didn't have a celebrity versus having a celebrity, how do you score that? And it goes, okay, we're going to, it's a 4X. No, it's a 3.8X.
Yeah. Well, you know, I hate to say it, but, you know, products are kind of a dime a dozen, you know, I mean, there's always going to be competition. There's always going to be other, you know, products that are competition, whether it's the same product or similar products. And so, you know, what really gets a product to stand out is, you know, the brand and, you know, what's attached to it. And so if a company has a celebrity attached to it, I mean, that's going to be a much more valuable company and they're going to command a higher multiple easily. So, you know, I would give like, you know, an e-com company that has a great product, but not a really good brand. Let's just say, you know, to your question a second ago that, you know, it's a company that is that lives off of paid advertising, you know, 90 to 100% of their sales comes from that. You know, they would probably get like a 2 to 2.5, you know, more or less. Whereas a company that is more established and has maybe some sort of, ambassador, some sort of influencer behind the brand, you know, they're more eligible to get like a 2.5 to 3.5, depending on other characteristics in the brand.
Yeah. And what about longevity? Do you look for companies that have been around for 5 years or longer, or 10 years? Or
you can say something like,
one of your guys is like 3 years into this and he's doing real well with it, but he wants to sell.
Yeah. No, that gives weight. I mean, you know, we're always looking for 10-year companies. We don't want to buy a company that's only been around for like a year. It hasn't, you know, really been around long enough. You know, that could be just a, you know, flash in the pan success. Like our next two acquisitions that we're closing at the end of this month to mid-September, you know, these are, you know, both 10-year companies, especially one of them. One of them has been around for 6 years, for example. So we're always looking for companies that have been, you know, around for, you know, several years at minimum.
Yeah. And what weight do you put on the motivation for selling? What's the motive for selling for that? I mean, it's like if it's a 25-year-old, he just luckily got, you know, he hit a home run in the first attempt versus a guy that's, you know, been doing it for a while and he's just tired and wants to retire. That's kind of a both ends of the spectrum.
Yeah, I hear you. I wouldn't put a whole lot of, you know, weight either way. I mean, you know, you always want to try to, you know, meet them where they're at and appeal to, you know, their why for selling in order to get them to the finish line. So that's the weight that I would apply there is I would try to, you know, find a way to make it a win-win in our conversations and the offer, et cetera. So this way, you know, it's good business for everybody involved.
Yeah. What do you do with businesses you seem to be overvalued? I mean, it's a nice business and it's a little bit overvalued, maybe just by 1x.
Yeah. I mean, you know, for example, I'll use an example I have right now on my table or my desk, I should say. So I've got a business that is owned by a friend of mine that I've known for about 9 years now, quite some time. And it's a great business. I mean, it nets $2 million annually. And he literally works maybe like 2 days a week. He's got five team members. I mean, it's a very efficient business and it's very well known in the entrepreneur space. It's a media company. It's not a physical product e-commerce company, but I see a lot
of synergy. Does this guy drive around in a Rolls Royce in Phoenix?
No.
No. Okay.
No. But so he's valuing his company at a 7x, which is really, really aggressive. You know, I don't know if it's really worth that. You know, in this case, like I would turn to people that have more M&A experience than I do, and I would get their feedback on this, you know, and see what they say, you know, when it comes to approaching this business and talking to him about buying a majority share of his business, you know, because I've got people around me that have been doing this much longer than I have. They really know how to value a business properly and, you know, they'll advise me accordingly. And, you know, I'll go from there. You know, I mean, I might keep the 7X. If it's his offer, then it's our terms. Yeah. You know, cause I go according to this rule, their offer, our terms, or our offer, their terms. Uh-huh. You know, so, you know, it's hard to answer that question, you know, just because every business and every situation is unique. If a business is, you know, overvalued, you typically ground it and, you know, come at them with a much lower offer. And then you start from there. You know, it's just like, you know, it's just like any negotiating, you know, you try to, you know, get them to start low with you. And then, you know, you try to, you know, you work your way up and, you know, meet somewhere in the middle where it makes sense.
Yeah. Let me go back to the armed five. Is that a process of building a company or is that buying a company?
Is that that's a marketing strategy and a marketing process. There's actually nine key systems in the RM5 formula. So there's nine systems, but you know, that's just our methodology for scaling an e-commerce company.
Did you know over 80% of listed businesses never sell, but you don't have to be one of them. The Magnolia Firm Rapid Acquisition Club removes the most time-consuming stages of selling by featuring your company directly to live qualified buyers, where you will have the opportunity to receive an offer immediately, live. This is perfect for sellers wanting a quick and low hassle acquisition. And I've asked them to waive the $2,500 fee. If you mentioned you saw this on my podcast, to be featured in the Rapid Acquisition Club and sell your business fast, click on the link below.
I think you know Michael Berislavsky out of Thailand. He will buy these small content companies, and he does four things, right? You know, he gets the backlinks up, he creates more content, you know, and he gets it SEO ready, and then he monetizes it. Then he sells it for 10x what he bought it for. And he's worked on a couple of funds himself. What do you guys do? Nice. Tell me about this ARM 5 or these nine methodologies that you do.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, ARM 5, I mean, it stands for authority, reciprocity, and monetization, and the five profit amplifiers. And so basically what it means is that if you establish an authority in a market, if you create real reciprocity by putting out valuable content on a consistent basis, and you have good monetization strategies and processes in play, that you're going to see success, you know, in growing a business. And so we really focus on those three pillars with all of our companies by applying the ARM 5 formula. And then the nine key systems, I mean, there's, you know, I could pull up what those are, but there's, you know, cause there's quite a bit here, but you know, there's omnichannel advertising, for example. You know, there's scaling methodologies, there's our testing matrix. I mean, there's content marketing. You know, there's nine key systems that in a way are fundamental to running an e-com business. But most e-com business owners or teams in e-com businesses or agencies, they're not running these nine systems the way we are. And they're not running it the way we are at the level that we're running it at, too. Because I've got a team, too, behind me that's done over $650 million indirect marketing literally over the last two decades. So I've got a very tenured, experienced, seasoned team that know how to really apply our strategies and our processes at a very high level. So that's, you know, what we do with the ARM 5 formula, and that's what the ARM 5 formula stands for.
Yeah. Let me ask you, go back and ask you about the market size. What does the market size have to be for you to say, you know, for instance, I'm just thinking about this one company that I looked at over Christine McDaniel has a company, but it's a, you know, it's probably a limited market, and but it's cranking out, you know, 200K of SDE year over year for the last 10 years, but it's a small market. It's not going to go to 1 million. Hmm. What do you need to see in a market for this to be an exciting project for you or an acquisition target?
Yeah. You know, I mean, I don't know much about the market or the business besides what you just said, but my initial thoughts are how deep has this business gone into the market? You know, yeah. Meaning that how much have they really monetized their customers? Because there's probably some opportunity there, because I've seen it, you know, time and time again in consulting with e-com companies, advising e-com companies, or just working on e-com companies that, you know, typically a lot of e-com companies aren't, you know, really maximizing their profit on the back end. So there probably is more there to tap into. Beyond that too, let's just say we're talking about a US market, right? Okay, so the US market is very limited, and they're doing a great job, but there's maybe a little bit more there they can tap into. But then once they tap into it, what's next? Well, replicate the business for other markets and other languages. I mean, there's plenty of customers out there around the world. And so that's the direction we would take that business, is we would replicate the business for a different market with a different language, and we would just run advertising in those markets. And the nice thing about that, too, is that, you know, let's just say it's a U.S.-based business. It's going to be more competitive in the U.S., and you're going to pay more per customer and per click. So we take it to, let's just say, Germany, for example. You know, this is a much smaller market, a much cheaper market, not as sophisticated as the U.S., and so we're going to probably see a lot more profit anyway coming from expanding, you know, to Germany, for example. So there's always opportunities is basically what I'm getting at.
You know, that I saw Mr. Beast on Joe Rogan, and he goes, you know, only, 5-7% of the population that speaks English. That's like the rest of the world does not speak English.
Right.
So then he goes, what are you going to do? And he goes, like, we just translate it to the, you know, the language in that country.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a very, you know, easy scaling, you know, methodology. You know, I mean, you know, there's a lot of entrepreneurs that do that. It's, you know, it's really easy to be able to expand a business when you scale horizontally like that.
Yeah. So what What does your cap stack look like? You, let's say you find a $5 million e-commerce business. It's got great potential, clean books, owner wants out, very flexible, ethical. Everything looks like a green light. Okay, we need to make them an offer. What do those offers look like? Is it a lot of cash down or 5% cash down or what is it?
Yeah. I mean, it depends. It depends on, you know, for one, you know, what they're looking for, you know, in the sale of their business, you know, because again, you know, you always want to, you know, have a win-win. And then two, it really depends on the size of the purchase, because if we're purchasing a business, you know, let's just say in our buy box between 1 and 5 million, you know, we've got various ways we can buy a business like that right now. I mean, we've got SBA loans with partners in our investor community that we could possibly use towards a purchase here. And SBA loans are very favorable, you know, 10-year payment terms, interest.
Yeah, but you can only have, you as an individual can only have one SBA loan.
That's why we have partners. You know, that's why we've invited investors in our community to co-own businesses with us and apply for SBA loans with our partners at Ecom Lending. And hold the guarantees, you know,
while
we do all the work. Oh yeah, I know Steven. Yeah, I've spoken with Steven. He's a good guy. So that's one option. But then we've also got relationships with different investment groups. We also have relationships with companies that actually raise the capital, you know, for a purchase. I mean, so we've got different ways we can skin the cat. And in the future, you know, we're gonna have our own private equity fund and company too. And we're going to have, you know, different funnels driving people to, you know, invest in the fund. And, you know, our goal there is to raise at least 10 million. And then we've got financial partners throughout the world that can 4X that cash too and turn it into 40 million even. And now we have a much bigger fund that we can go and buy really good businesses with, you know, using our now, you know, very sophisticated, rigorous process that has come out of, pain that we felt from our early acquisitions. So, you know, that's how we're able to buy businesses right
now. Are those investment groups, for instance, like Justin over at Empire Flippers, you know, they've got a group, you know, a lot of the e-commerce lenders, e-commerce sellers that they sold to didn't want to do it over again themselves, but they're willing to put their money behind somebody else, operators. Mm-hmm. So they started a fund. Are you talking about those kind of groups, or are these separate groups that you've created relationships with, or are they always looking for new products to invest in?
Yeah, no, these are separate groups that just my network has led to, or, you know, different masterminds I'm in, different groups I'm in has led to those, you know, connections. You know, I'm familiar with Empire Flippers and, you know, their private equity fund. You know, our private equity fund, you know, is definitely going to be very similar to that. You know, the difference is that obviously we own it versus us collaborating with them and they own it. You know, they're in the driver's, you know, seat there. So they have the most leverage, which is why we haven't reached out to them and, you know, tried to work something out there. You know, we want to do our own thing. But yeah, the Rolodex of, you know, financing options has come from just our own work and our own network.
Yeah. How long does that process take? So you say, hey, we love the business. You get an LOI, you sign it, and you put some kind of presentation together with the investors and say, this is what we can do to it. These are the opportunities, and this is what we're going to. Now, it's a buy and hold, right? It's not a buy and sell, right, at the moment.
Yeah. No. Yeah, we're not trying to immediately flip businesses. We're not in that business. We're in the business of holding a business for at least 12 plus months and scaling it up during that time and increasing its valuation and selling it. But we also don't want to sell them individually necessarily. We may consider it if a good offer comes along, but you know, we want to package them because when you package businesses, you get a much higher multiple. And it also benefits everybody involved since each business will also have max value since we're getting a bigger multiple. And so that's why, you know, right now our model is inviting investors one-to-one into our companies to be a part of these companies as we purchase them.
And these are separate LLCs of a holding company?
Yeah. We have it all, you know, structured, you know, correctly. I laughed just because I've learned so much about, you know, the things that I'm doing right now. It's just crazy how far I've come over the last 18 months. But yeah, I mean, we have our holding company that owns or co-owns all of our companies, and each company has its own LLC. So we're doing things right, clean, organized, segmented, you name it.
Yeah. And when you send the presentation out to these investors, and it's a, you said it was like, we talked a little bit before we got on the phone, you got about an email list of 1,000 potential high net worth individuals. That's what you said? Something like that?
Well, actually, we have 17,000.
17,000 investors.
And but we have a private Facebook group of over 1,000 that are investors, you know, that have been attracted to the opportunity of investing into e-com due to the returns you can get in e-com. But our entire list, even though it's primarily like e-com business owners from the last 10 plus years, a lot of them have converted over into becoming investors, being interested in what
they
do. So we actually have a very large audience.
And what do you ask for them? Let's say you've got a business that's 5 million top line and it's doing 15%. So you're going to buy it at a 4X. And you're going to bring, you always bring how much cash to the party and then some debt, and then you have a gap that you need investors to do. What does that look like?
Yeah. So you're talking about $3 million purchase.
About a $3 million. Yeah. Yep. 15%, 4X of, that's 750,000. So 3X. Yes.
Yep. So that would be like, probably an SBA purchase, first and foremost, you know, just because we have, as of right now, and I'm sure we can get more of them, we have pre-approved SBA loans up to $3 million, for example. So that would be probably, you know, what we would use as a vehicle to be able to purchase a business like that. Obviously, it's going to come down to the offer terms, and you know, there might be less money up front. You know, we might do, like, ideally, we're going to always do some sort of like at least 75-25, meaning 75% of the value, you know, which is 2.5, I believe. 2.5 million would be like upfront, while the rest of it would be like on earnout. And the reason why we'd like to do a deal like that with those offer terms is because the fact that it's going to encourage the owner seller to really care about the ongoing success of the company, and also in the handoff, you know, because we definitely want the owner seller to be, you know, really invested in our success with the company. And so we're always going to do something like that in every single offer that we put together.
Yeah. Well, what would you say if they didn't want to do that? Would you kill the deal? And the reason I say that is I referred a business to another guy that puts MSPs, IT companies in front of private equity, and they asked him to stay on. They didn't want to stay on, so they just killed the deal.
Yeah, I gotcha.
That simple. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's a case by case basis. You know, I mean, if the business, if we're supremely confident we can step into the business and we can have success with the business right away, you know, we may not care as much about, you know, having some sort of earnout like that and having the owner seller really invested in our success. But in most cases, we would want, you know, the owner seller to be invested in our success. It just really depends on the business.
Yeah. And when you say you bring these partners in with investors, and I think the SBA 51% has to, you know, you're going to put a personal guarantee up. Like, who are these people? How do you vet them and say, okay, this is a brand new guy, would you like to run this? And how do you know this guy's going to do the job for you, or guy, girl, whatever?
Yeah. So we have, you know, really good relationships with all of our investors that we brought on. And, you know, we've had, you know, several investors, you know, show interest and apply and get approved for SBA loans. And they've done so with, you know, the terms that they're going to own 25% of the company that they're purchasing with us. But they're not going to be doing any of the work. You know, they're not going to be doing anything. They're just going to basically just sit on, you know, this as an asset for them. And, and so, you know, that's the structure that we've been following with all the investors that have been approved for SBA loans, that we're exploring purchasing businesses with. Those are the terms we've been using.
So they're going to put their personal guarantee up. Are they putting any cash themselves also?
That's an option. We don't require it. So, you know, we go into the, you know, those agreements with some of our investors with the notion that we are going to provide the cash up front to close on the SBA loan. So this way they don't. So it's a very favorable deal for them because, you know, they are putting some risk up front, obviously, with the guarantee, but no cash, you know, I mean, so they're going to be, you know, owning 25% of an asset that could produce cash for them, you know, basically for free, you know, which is incredible. Yeah. And ridiculous.
Do they get dividends or percentage of the profits or they just, okay.
Yeah. They get 25%, you know, net profits, whether we do it monthly or quarterly or yearly, even, they get 25% of the future sale of the company. You know, even though we're doing all the heavy lifting, you know, from point A to Z, you know, when it comes to identifying the business, buying the business, you know, managing the business, growing the business, you know, setting the business up for sale, selling the business, we're doing all that.
Yeah. And this LLC that they purchased, this entity here, is it just the value of their equity in the holding company? Let's say you sell this in 5 years to a private equity company for $100 million. And do they get a percentage of this holding company?
No, it's still, right now we're doing one-to-one deals, meaning that we're doing, you know, deals on each of our individual, you know, companies that we're purchasing. So the holding company is 100% owned by me. And, you know, in the future, when we go to package and sell, you know, in a portfolio roll-up, what we'll probably do, and, you know, I'll lean on people smarter than me and more experienced than me when it comes to this, but what we'll probably do is we'll probably just transition all these companies into a new holding company, and that will be the holding company that we're basically packaging and selling.
Gotcha. And when you go to these people that are smarter than you and done all this stuff beforehand, what are they saying? Say, keep doing this SBA partner stuff, or do they say, hey, you need to raise a fund so you can go take advantage of opportunities fast?
Yeah, no, I mean, they think altogether everything I'm doing is smart so far, you know, they do recommend that we work towards having a private equity fund and company. And, you know, right now we're in the midst of making that transition and actually having like a Reg D and a Reg A company, which is exciting. It's definitely something new, you know, that I never thought in a million years that I'd be doing, you know, at one point in my life. But it's cool that, you know, we're about to unlock, you know, that exciting opportunity for ourselves and also for investors out there, you know, because we'll be able to use the Reg A side to really appeal to the masses. We'll be able to market to just about anybody, drive them into using a phone app where they can use Apple Pay to, you know, invest $100 even, you know, and then we'll be also working with, you know, accredited investors in the Reg D side of the company and working to raise capital that way too, into our, you know, private equity fund and company that we're building. So we have some exciting opportunities on the horizon.
Yeah. I've worked on Reg A's, and I always thought Reg A's are great for e-commerce companies because you have a big list you can go to. It goes, hey, you like the product. Would you like to own part of the company too? They go, well, what is it? This is $100. You mean I got to go part of a company for $100? Yes, I'll do it. Right.
Yeah.
So when you go in, do you have a mastermind that you actually go to that when you start asking these questions, or is it a loosely, hey, I got this guy on my speed dial and I'll just give him a call because we've done some business together in the past or something?
Both.
Both. Yeah. What kind of masterminds do you go to?
I'm in the Powerhouse mastermind currently, ran by Josh Snow and Los Hustle. It's an e-com centric group. And so I'm officially a part of that right now. I've been in other masterminds over the years. I've been in the Digital Marketer Certified Partner program at one point was kind of like a semi mastermind. It's now a much bigger program, but
is
I
that
was one of the
Ryan Dice Digital Marketer. Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Like I was one of the first 12, and that was late 2014. Yeah, from that point on, I mean, I've been in, Baby Bathwater. I've, been in Ollie Bilson's, Next Level Business.
Ollie's doing something different, isn't he now?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I was with him, and I think he's still doing this, he's teaching basically like service-based companies to transition into a more scalable one-to-many model is what he's been doing for a while now. And, you know, he's awesome. And I've been in some other groups too over the years. Ryan Levesque's Next Level. Funny they both have the same name, actually, now that I think of it. But Ryan Levesque's group was called Next Level Mastermind also. But, you know, that,
if you're starting a mastermind, don't call it that.
There's too many next level masterminds out there these days. But Ryan's moved on to bigger and better things. I was there for the closing of that mastermind as he transitioned out of it.
Yeah. And how long have you stayed with your masterminds? I mean, I was introduced to a couple masterminds recently. Now, everybody knows like Tiger 21, you got to have a net worth over 10 million or something. Rob Dyrdek's in there, and he's increased his wealth, and they stay for a long time. What do you look for in a mastermind? For, you know, what you put in, you get out, or what is it that, like, you're looking for somebody that's done 10x what you've done?
Yeah, you know, it just depends on what I'm looking for. You know, like when I joined Powerhouse, you know, I was looking for a group that was e-com centric. I mean, I thought about joining Genius Network. You know, Joe Polish used to be a client. You know, Genius Network used to be a client of ours when we were an agency. You know, we did some great work with them, and I've still got a great relationship with Joe. You know, and I thought about joining, like, you know, War Room. War Room obviously closed since then. And then, but, you know, at the time I was wanting a group that could really support us as an e-com aggregator and could support the team too, and give the team access to, you know, people that, you know, we can lean on, and also education and trainings and things like that. And so, you know, that's why I chose Powerhouse. But so, you know, I'm always looking for, you know, a group to join where it makes sense based on, you know, what our motivations are at the time.
Yeah. But you stay with them?
Yeah, at least a year. I mean, you know, we've been with Powerhouse for a little bit over a year now, I believe, or at least close to it. So, you know, I think we're about to cross the year if we haven't already. But yeah, usually I stay in a mastermind for at least a year.
And what do you do? How do you handle problems? If you got a significant problem, where do you go for inspiration? Is it just like the mastermind, or you go back and meditate? Or you go out for a, you know, 15-mile jog in Phoenix in August?
Well, I'm not that crazy, but, you know, I have been, you know, I have been crazy. I used to be a marathon runner, and I used to run in the heat sometimes. You know, I wouldn't care. I would just suck it up and just go. You know, I wouldn't care if it's 115 outside. I would just suck it up and just do it.
I always say, it's like I drive along. I'm down in Tucson, which is only 5 degrees cooler, and I'm looking like, those guys are freaking crazy. You're nuts. Yeah.
I know. You know, but it feels good to be crazy. It feels good to, like, do crazy things, and it feels good to, you know, do things that other people won't do. And push
just
yourself
to know you're alive. What's that song?
Yeah. I don't know.
Cut yourself to know you're alive. Yeah.
I definitely like to live on, you know, the edge when it comes to pushing myself physically, but, But yeah, I mean, you know, to answer your question, I mean, you know, I do meditate just about daily, and I do, you know, go to church, or at least watch it on, you know, YouTube, streaming on Sundays. So I definitely, you know, turn to a higher power for wisdom, you know, every single day. But, besides that, I mean, you know, I turn to the people that I'm connected with, you know, friends, mentors, you know, trusted advisors, for feedback, you know, when I need it, you know, 'cause I definitely, you know, don't have all the answers. I'm only a human being, and I'm just doing my best. And, you know, what I need to do is I need to, you know, lean on others or on the higher power, you know, to, you know, be led in the right direction.
Yeah. I have to ask you a personal question. So your net worth has obviously grown immensely from an agency now to a, you know, owner of a 14, you know, company. What's changed most about you? I mean, is it the money that's like, oh, that's great, but it's just a marker, it's a scoreboard, it's how I've grown?
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. Yeah, I appreciate that question. You know, I would, you know, it's funny. As this has happened, I've also become a family man. And, you know, I was single for 10 years. I was single for a very long time. And, I was having fun, you know, being a single guy, but, you know, eventually it just, you know, eventually it got to a point where I really felt like I, had to, work on myself and work on my spirituality. And, I did that for several years before I met my fiance. So as I've had this, tremendous success, which I'm super grateful for over the last, 18 plus months, I've also become a family man. I have a baby girl now. She's 4 months old.
What's her name?
Scarlet.
Ooh, that's a pretty name.
Yeah. Yeah. Scarlet Destiny. So she was, she was named Destiny for a reason. I saw her in a, let's just say a spiritual awakening back in 2020. I saw her in my dreams, you could say. And, it's been a journey. I would say that it's just like what people say. People say that when you have money, it only magnifies who you are. And as I've had this success, I'm feeling a little emotional even thinking about it. I haven't really changed, who I am. If anything, it's just it's caused me to remain very strong in my values. Because, I don't want to get away from my values. I want to stay strong in who I am. And my life has become simpler too. I've gone from, living in, Scottsdale, downtown Scottsdale, for example, where, if you've been to Scottsdale, then that you see, nice cars everywhere. You see, lots of beautiful women left and right. And, it's a different life, and, when you're around that, that's kind of what you care about. And now I'm living in suburbia. I'm living in Chandler, Arizona. I'm living in a private community. And, I go home to my family. I spend time with my family and, I don't go out much, these days. And so it's different. So, I mean, I think the bottom line to answer your question is it really hasn't changed me much. If anything, it's just, because of where I've taken my personal life as my professional life has changed and the successes have come from that, it's really grounded me.
Yeah. What forced you? It sounds like your why has changed. I mean, what forced you to go from this living the lifestyle in downtown Scottsdale to nice cars to like, hey man, I'm going to go clean some diapers. Right.
God, you just made me think of like, my baby girl's diaper. I just had to change like yesterday. I think it was,
They stink, don't they?
It was terrible. I knew for a while that, I wanted to have a family. And I have a 14-year-old son. So, I've been a father for quite some time, but I was a single dad, throughout the last, 13 years. And, I knew for a while that I wanted to, settle down and, have a family and, embrace that life. And, what you put out into the universe intentionally is what's going to happen. And that's the intentions that I put out there. So I was okay with walking away from, where I was at before I met my fiance and where I'm at now.
Yeah. Beautiful. Josh, thank you so much for being on this show. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate it. You're bringing me, into a very sensitive place right now. I feel kind of flushed with emotion right now. So I'm, it's hard to express myself right now.
Yeah. I think you're doing a great job because you can't have intention without emotion behind it. And the emotion is, what's important to you. It's your why.
Right. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for being on.
Yeah. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it, man.
This video has inspired you. If you need help buying your first $1 million business, make sure to visit me at dealflowsystem.net. If you like this video, make sure you subscribe down below. Comment on it, share it, tell everyone about it. And thanks for watching.